You are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Season 2 and another episode of the Joseph Campbell Foundation podcast, Pathways with Joseph Campbell. I'm your host, Bradley Olson. On this podcast, we continue to share archived audio lectures given by Joseph Campbell over the course of his teaching and lecturing career. On this episode of Pathways with Joseph Campbell, we're listening to a lecture from December 11th, 1982, that Joseph Campbell presented at the San Francisco Jung Institute, called The Art and Mythology of Thomas Mann. The C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco was founded alongside San Francisco's Medical Society for Analytical Psychology in 1943. It was the first Jungian analytic training program in the world and continues to offer training programs and courses to mental health professionals and licensed psychotherapists. By comparison, the Jung Institute in Zurich didn't open its doors until 1948. The founders of the San Francisco Jung Institute were Jane and Joseph Wheelwright, who studied under Jung and Tony Wolf in Zurich. Joe Wheelwright taught psychiatry at the UC San Francisco Medical Center for 30 years, and Jane Wheelwright's maiden name was Hollister, a family that once owned 200,000 acres of land stretching from Monterey County to Santa Barbara, and was by most accounts a remarkable woman. Jane Wheelwright died in 2004 at the age of 98. Her husband predeceased her in 1999, and it's likely that both of them were in the audience for this lecture of Campbell's. Thomas Mann was not simply a great novelist. He was also a fascinating man, complex, surprising, difficult to know, and a literary genius who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1929. He also spent the majority of his life in exile. I think that, unfortunately, too many American readers of literature are unfamiliar with Mann. It's possible to go through an entire undergraduate literature major without reading him. But Mann is a quintessential modernist, even though, as Campbell points out, his fiction seems to wear the camouflage of 19th century naturalism. But Mann is every bit as much of a modernist and every bit as much of a mythographer as James Joyce was. Every bit as layered, as experimental, as novel, despite that he composed, as Alec Ross said in a recent New Yorker piece, in a high bourgeois style. From my perspective, the difference between them is that Mann's fiction is somehow quieter, more introverted than Joyce's. Campbell remarks in this lecture that he met Thomas Mann on three occasions and described Mann as being, quote, very formal in his manner, but with ease, unquote, which to me reflects Mann's German Lutheran introversion. Like most human beings, Thomas Mann was a complex, often self-contradictory figure who used his formality of bearing to contain what for him were perhaps dangerous passions. After his diaries were published between 1977 and 1995, one could see how consumed he was by his unexpressed, sublimated sexual attraction to men, and surely that formal, reserved, Apollonian manner served to contain the indulgent, Dionysian self-forgetting that man may have intensely longed for. Mann often remarked that he found material rather than invented it, and indeed, it isn't hard to see the author's presence in most of his works, especially Buddenbrook's Death in Venice, Tonio Kroger, The Magic Mountain, and Dr. Faustus. In an essay titled Erotic Irony and Mythic Forms in the Art of Thomas Mann, which is in part where Campbell draws the material for the lecture we're listening to today, Professor Campbell reflected on Mann's remarks about Freud, that Freud never read Nietzsche, Novalis, Kierkegaard, and, quote, knew nothing of Ibsen, who had shown that the lie and little lies of life are absolutely necessary in the interests of survival, unquote. And yet, Freud somehow managed to recover 19th century romantic philosophy and medicalize it, employing it in the service of science. And like the experience I sometimes have reading Ibsen, it isn't always pleasant to reflect on exactly how necessary the lies of life are to one's survival, as well as to one's identity. Facing the hard, unadulterated truth of ourselves can sometimes lead to a catastrophic decompensation. As Nietzsche wrote in The Will to Power, we have art. And by the word art, Nietzsche means the comforting illusion, the beautiful lie. We have art, he says, in order not to die of the truth. So please enjoy Joseph Campbell's 1982 lecture on the art and mythology of Thomas Mann. And immediately following his talk, I'll be back with some final remarks and explore some of the important and interesting ideas from the lecture. And now, Joseph Campbell.
In 1936, there was a very amusing occasion. Thomas Mann was invited to give the talk at the party in honor of Freud's 80th birthday. Now, how anyone could have thought that an artist could talk about anyone but himself, I can't imagine. And it was amusing. Thomas Mann started by saying he didn't understand why he had been invited to do this, because he was an artist, a creator, and not a scientist, not an analyst. He was the object of scientific inquiry, not the subject. So he said, well, perhaps what people wanted was a Saturnalia, a topsy-turvy evening, where the one who usually is the object becomes the subject. And instead of a talk based on a practical science and so forth, we'd have one of dreamlike penetration. Now, you know, in the Saturnalia, everything is topsy-turvy. The servants are commanding their employers, and a clown is appointed judge of the city and so forth, and everything's upside down. So this was a warning that Mann was going to be a little bit rough. Now, the paper that was published of this talk is called Freud and the Future. As I say, it had almost nothing to do with Freud. Mann begins by saying that the real achievement of Freud was that he had, through his own researchers, reproduced in medical terms all the findings of the German romantic philosophers of the 19th century, even though Freud had never read any of these. He did not know Schopenhauer, says Mann. He did not know Nietzsche. He did not know Kierkegaard. And out of his ignorance on his own boat, you know, he had reproduced the whole thing. Then he said, now, if you will pardon me for talking about myself, I will show that in my works, long before I heard of Freud, I was already working in this mode. And he then spoke of his early short story, Der kleine Herr Friedmann, Little Mr. Friedmann. And this was published in 1896 or 7. That's 4 or 3 years before Freud's interpretation of dreams. And it's a fact that in that little story, you get a good deal of Freudian information, or the information that Freud then produced also in other language. and with a totally different slant. About halfway through the lecture, Bond mentioned the unutterable name, namely of Jung, and how Jung was inspiring the work that he was doing now, which was his Joseph novels. He had just finished volume 3. I can't imagine what went on in that room while he was doing this. Now, I bring this up because it is a very good lead into the whole context of what was going on in the realm of unconscious research, you might say, in the first half of this century. This was a wonderful period in the arts. I'm going later to be talking about Joyce. And Joyce and Mann, completely ignorant of each other, went through simultaneously a transition in their novels, in their writing, from what might be called 19th century naturalism through the psychological accent given in their works to a breakthrough into myth. The First World War comes along, and immediately after it, these two epochal books appear, Joyce's Ulysses, 1922, and Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, 1924. And both of these pretended, so to say, to be naturalistic works, but they were structured on a mythological base. And the mythological structure was given to you in a clue in the title, Ulysses and the Magic Mountain. Then they slide right into the whole sea of myth in their next great works, Thomas Mann's Joseph novels and Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. And they came out, well, Finnegan's Wake came out around 1939. And Mann had already started his Joseph novels at that time. It took him a long time. The thing built up for Mann as he went into the material. Now, interesting in contrast is that Joyce was a Catholic, Irish Catholic, and Thomas Mann had been brought up a German Protestant. Now, a Catholic is brought up in a mythological ambience. You, insofar as you take the religion seriously, you're living in immediate relationship to myth. And, of course, the problem then is to relate your experiences when you move into the world to this mythological ground, to see the world in terms of those structures which have been put in you in the beginning. Thomas Mann comes the other way around. One of the characteristics of Protestantism, I would say, is that it rejects the ritual and mythological interpretation and accent in the religion. And so Mann comes gradually into a realization of the mythological depths and what they implied and all. This gave Joyce a kind of advantage there, that he was a professional in mythological thinking right from infancy. And Mann comes gradually into it. And this makes the two of them an extraordinarily interesting pair to bring together. Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain is a work in which Mann is continually explaining the implication of his mythology. He gives you the image, and then there's a interpretation that's given you one way or another. Joyce does nothing of the kind. Joyce just gives it to you, bing, like that, and you've got to work into it. So I have always found in my own reading and thinking about these matters that these two men supplement each other in an extraordinarily interesting way, and also in their approach to art. Now, in their backgrounds, and this is what I want to talk about this morning at any rate, are the German philosophers of the 19th century. very important influence in the years of their growing up was, of course, Wagner. And here was a man who was operating in the field of myth with virtuosic power. And both of them took some themes from Wagner. Now, one of the musical devices Wagner used is that of the leitmotif, the cliché that is associated with a certain body of meaning and a system of associations which recurs. And every time it recurs, the whole meaning of it comes back again in new relationships. For Thomas Mann, this device, anyone who's read Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, for instance, or any of his early short stories, has recognized this. When he mentions a character, he will always mention some little context of adjectives or commentary that he has mentioned before with respect to this character. So the whole thing comes in again. This is the leitmotif. And Joyce, who is a very musical person, one of the great, what can I say, disappointments of his life was that in a singing contest in Dublin, he didn't win. John McCormick won. So he uses the musical device also, a recurrent refrain. Back of that, we come to the philosophers that influence the two of them. Now, the philosopher that influenced Wagner the most was Schopenhauer. As Nietzsche says at one point, Brünnhilde, between acts 1 and 2, goes out and reads The World as Will and Idea and comes back and sings it. And when you read Wagner's autobiography, he tells you that the great crisis was reading of Schopenhauer's World as Will and Idea. And he said, from then on, I had it at my side all the time. Now, what I should talk about, therefore, is Schopenhauer's World's Will and Idea. But when you pick up Schopenhauer's World's Will and Idea, which came, it was already formed in his mind by about 1818, you realize, I can't understand this until I've read Kant. So then you have to go back another notch to Immanuel Kant. And this is not so easy. Schopenhauer says of Kant, Kant is distinguished by eine glänzende Trockenheit, a brilliant dryness. And when I was teaching at Sarah Lawrence, teaching this material, I would give my students to read the first section of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, Transcendental Aesthetic, and it gave me a chance to see what kind of students I had. And in teaching during 38 years, I found one student who could come in after that assignment and tell me what Kant had said. But what he says isn't so difficult. It's simply the approach that he takes to the saying of it. When the moon shot before the one with Armstrong in it who came down onto the moon, when that module was coming back from going around the moon, Houston, the ground control, said, and I remember hearing this on the TV, who is navigating now? And the answer that came back was Newton. Well, that hit me hard. I thought, this is terrific. And I immediately thought of Kant's essay on a prolegomena to any metaphysic whatsoever, where Kant asks, how is it that we can make mathematical calculations in this space and know with apodictic certainty that those calculations will hold in another space? Now, there were those chaps out there around the moon where nobody had ever been before. And it was known exactly how much energy had to be expelled from the jets and at what angle to bring them down within a mile of a battleship in the Pacific Ocean. This was known before they got there. The characteristics of space, no matter where, are known. They're the characteristics of our own mind. They're known before the experience, and so they're called prior knowledge, a priori knowledge. On the other hand, when Armstrong's foot came down on the moon, you can remember seeing that, no one knew how far his boot was going to go into moon dust. That is a posteriori knowledge. That's the kind of knowledge you get after the experience. How is it that calculations with respect to time and space can be made with apodictic certainty for times and spaces that you have not yet visited? It's because these forms are in the mind. And these are what Kant discusses in that first section of the Critique of Pure Reason, which is called Transcendental Aesthetic. And by the word aesthetic, he means having to do with the sense experience. Aesthetic means having to do with the senses. All of our experiences take place within a field of time and space. And they take place within that field because that is the field of our mentality. This is the realm of phenomenality, phenomenon, the objects. We are all in space and time, extending in space, enduring in time. Now, if there were no space, we wouldn't be separate from each other. If there were no time, we wouldn't be separate from the people who were in this room, say, last week. So space and time are what give separateness. And all of our empirical experience is conditioned by time and space. That's Kant's first principle. However, we can have an intuitive experience that disregards time and space. And Schopenhauer speaks of this in a very important paper that he wrote some many years into the 19th century, called The Foundations of Morality. And there he asks, how is it that a human being can so experience the pain and danger and peril of another that, forgetting his own self-protection, he moves spontaneously to the other's rescue, even at the risk of his own life? He doesn't do it out of duty. He doesn't do it out of intention. It is suddenly his impulse to save that person. A child's about to be hit by a car, you go out and you get hit. This goes on all the time. Schopenhauer asks, how is it that the first law of nature, the maintenance and protection of this separate entity, can suddenly be dissolved and another principle take over? And he says, it's because you and that other are one. He said, this is a metaphysical realization. Primarily, separateness is secondary. And unity, identity, is the prime condition. There can be then another approach to this. And it's the approach of identifying yourself. You know, the Hindus ask you, who am I? This is a big discipline. Am I this body? I was once giving a lecture to a group of prep school boys on Buddhism. And how could I render this idea to them? Because what is called Buddha consciousness is the one consciousness of which we are all manifestations. We are all Buddha things. We are all separate manifestations of this great consciousness that informs the whole universe. The plants are conscious. The stones are conscious. All things are conscious. So I said to the boys, look up at the ceiling. You can say the lights, plural, are on, or you can say the light is on. These are two ways of saying exactly the same thing. The lights are on is accenting the individual vehicle, the bulb. And the light is on is accenting the general light. But there are two ways of saying exactly the same thing. Now, in Japan, the accent on the individual thing is called the jihokai, or the individual realm. And the accent on the general is called the rihokai, the general realm. And there's a little saying, ji, ri, mu, ge, individual, general, no obstruction, no difference. So when one light breaks, the superintendent of buildings and grounds doesn't come in and say, oh, I was particularly fond of that bulb. That was the important one. This is a calamity. Takes it out, puts another bulb in. What is important? It is the light, not the vehicle. And I said, now I look down at all your heads. And of what are these the vehicles? They are the vehicles of consciousness. So which are you? Are you the head or are you the consciousness? With what do you identify yourself? With the vehicle or with what is carried? And if you can identify yourself with what is carried, namely consciousness, that's the consciousness that's in all the bulbs. And so you are identifying yourself with that which is the unifying principle. And that's what the person identified himself with who went to save another person spontaneously. These are two approaches to the realization that the separateness is secondary. And the separateness is a function of the experience within time and space. Now, that's the basis of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, Part 1, Transcendental Aesthetic. And what he called the thing in itself, the Ding an sich, is no thing, because to be a thing, you have to be in time and space. So we're beyond all time and space. And that's our true being. There's a marvelous little story that Daisetsu Suzuki, that Zen philosopher, brought up in one of his talks about Zen. He tells of a young man who asked his guru, am I in possession of Buddha consciousness? And the guru said, no. And he said, well, I've heard that all things are in possession of Buddha consciousness, the stones, the trees, the flowers, the birds, the animals, all beings. Yes, said the master, you are correct. All things are in possession of Buddha consciousness. The stones, the flowers, the bees, the birds, but not you. Why not me? Because you're asking this question. That's to say, instead of living in the knowledge that comes from that transcendent source, he's living in the knowledge of himself as a separate unit. And that throws him off. So he isn't living out of his Buddha consciousness. Now the trick for the artist is so to present his material that it doesn't put a ring around itself and stand there as separate from you, the observer. And that aha that you get when you see artwork that really hits you is, I am that. I am the very radiance and energy that is talking to me through this thing. In purely empirical terms, it's called participation, but it's more than that, it's identification. So that's the first thing, and Thomas Mann and Joyce are working on this all the way through, and we're going to try to find out something about how they do it and what the results were. Now, there's a second part to Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and this is called the Transcendental Logic. And what he points out there is that the way we think is determined by our mind, not by the way things are. all of the relationships of grammar and of logic are functions of the mind. So we experience these objects in time and space, and then we think about them in terms of the categories of logic. Whereas the true mystery is beyond logic, is beyond time and space. Now, beyond logic means that all the words we ask, the questions we ask, have no relevance to the problem. The word God is supposed to be a reference to the ultimate mystery. But the ultimate mystery is beyond all form, beyond all names, beyond oneness, beyond multitude, one and many. These are categories of thought. So you're not talking about anything. And one of the problems in our religious tradition is it deals with God as though God were a fact. Can't be fact. We just don't have the words that open out into transcendence. The problem of these artists is to make everything open back into transcendence so that it doesn't glue you to itself. And when you think of God as a fact, you've lost the reference in the symbol. And this is why Meister Eckhart said, the great German mystic of the 13th and early 14th century, the ultimate leave-taking is the leaving of God for God. You leave the folk idea, the time and space determined image of God, for the mystery which is out beyond all that. Now what we've got to find is how the artist, how Joyce, how Mann, particularly today, Mann, has broken through and rendered this mystery. One way is through the rhythms of their prose. This is a problem of poetry. What the poet is doing is breaking you past the image, breaking you past the words so that things should point past themselves. Rhythm has a lot to do with this. Okay. Kant tells us all of our perceiving and thinking is conditioned by the a priori forms of our sensibility, time and space, and of our thinking. And he says the thing in itself, the thing an sich, is beyond our experience. We look at each other, but this mystery, do we see the oneness? Schopenhauer comes along and says, yeah, but I am the thing an sich. Of course I experience it. But I don't experience it this way. Am I in possession of Buddha consciousness? I am Buddha consciousness. Can you locate your mentality then so that it is in touch with this consciousness which antecedes mentality? There's a very interesting thing coming up. Apparently during the 60s and 70s, this whole idea of the hologram was worked out. And there have actually been lectures and talks about it here in San Francisco. So we're on home ground. The scientist has caught up on the early and late 18th century philosopher. And we have this wonderful new paradigm of the hologram. To me, it's a total mystery what they're talking about. I can't imagine how it works. But it has to do with a beam striking an object, and then another beam striking a mirror reflection of the object, and the two beams mixing and something coming out of it by way of laser beams and so forth and so on. But what you get is an image which, when you smash it and break it up, in every particle of it, you have the totality again. That's the old mythological idea that every one of us is a duplication of the macrocosm. The microcosm and the macrocosm are the same form. Now, the function of art, and Shakespeare was who said, art holds a mirror up to nature, art holds, you might say, a holographic mirror up to nature, so that you can see that in this object, is the totality. Each is a totality in itself, and this is the way these men deal with their characters. They are totals. They are not simply particles of a space field. They are, in some way or other, totals. Now, the world is will and idea. I just want to give some main thoughts about that, because it informs the writing, totally informs the writing of Thomas Mann, and informed the operas of Wagner. It informs Joyce, as we see. This is a very important philosopher. And he's put down by school philosophers because he's easy to read. He's easy to read. That's not just cricket. The ideas that he got were extremely lucidly presented. Just at the time that Kant wrote his Critique of Pure Reason, Europe was beginning to learn about Oriental philosophy. There was a young Frenchman, Anquetil du Perron, who joined the French army in order to go to India to fight the British in the end of the 18th century, the Franco-British wars, and the British conquest of India. He wanted to go to India because he knew he could get some information there about Oriental philosophy. And he actually published in Latin a Persian translation of some of the Upanishads. And this was called the Upnekat. Schopenhauer read it and immediately realized that Oriental philosophy and the idea of Maya and Kantian metaphysics were identical. Oh, it was Schopenhauer who was the first to bring Oriental terminology into Kantian thinking. So here, the beginning of the 19th century, 1818 or so, we have this synthesis of the two philosophies. And so it became possible for writers like Mann and Joyce to take in the whole enrichment of the Oriental understanding of transcendence and the Maya aspect of phenomenality, how it's all an illusion based on the mirror images of time and space, and render it in purely Occidental terms. This is a great, great moment. This comes in the beginning of the 19th century. So, the world als Wille und Vorstellung. Wille, we might translate today, energy, waves. Vorstellung, idea isn't good. Object, image. The world as wave or energy and as image. In physics, when they found that subatomic particles could be interpreted as particles or as waves, they hit exactly the same thing. This is the nature of the world. And this is what's coming up in this hologram idea. A complex of waves, seen through a certain kind of lens, you might say, becomes an image. Now, Pribram uses a very interesting analogy. We've all heard radio and phonograph sounds that come from two sources. The one source is here, the other is there, and yet the sound seems to be here. And we actually experience the object, namely the sound, where it isn't. Now, says Pribram, we're all that way. We all look as though we were here. This isn't where we are at all. We're these waves, you know, and looked at in a certain way, time, space, we have this secondary character. And so there are two ways of experiencing everything. You can interpret everything in terms of the visual relationships, cause and effect, or in terms of will. Now, you know what has happened in our mechanistic sciences, even the psyche is interpreted simply in terms of cause and effect. I respond because of a certain stimulus response. I'm walking along the street and I decide to go over there. Why did I decide to cross the street? Well, there was some display in a window, store window. So somebody asked me, why did you cross the street? Well, the scientist would say, because that store window display caused him to do this. And I would answer, because I wanted to. Now, we can take any object and put it down on the table and give it a push. Why did that nickel move? Because I hit it with my finger. But if you were to ask the nickel, it would say, oh, I decided I'd go over there. These two ways, from inside and from outside of the experience. I remember after one of my talks in one college campus where I was talking about yoga and how the function of yoga is to unite waking consciousness to the source of consciousness. Now, in our thinking normally, we think of consciousness as being a product of the brain, but that's not the way the Orient thinks. The brain is a product of consciousness. It's a vehicle and instrument of consciousness. Consciousness is what produces it. And I remember one professor asked me afterwards, what do you mean by consciousness? Well, he had the idea it all started up here. I said, well, I dare say you're speaking of consciousness as something that comes from the human brain. But I said, it goes much deeper than that. For instance, have you ever seen a polo game? He said, yes. Would you say that the horse was conscious of the game? Well, yes. How about a dog, a hunter's dog? Is he conscious of what the hell? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's get down to caterpillars, you know? And how about plants? Are they conscious of where the sun is? Is that why all of them? Well, he hadn't thought of it that way. And so I took a coin out of my pocket and I said, I'll bet you this coin knows just where the ground is. That's Schopenhauer. The will informs all of nature, all things are Buddha things. And a manifestation of consciousness on the purely physical level is gravity. On the plant level, it's heliotropism, the plants turning to the sun and so forth. There's a consciousness there. When I was a kid walking through the woods, I'd come every now and then, as anyone will, to a barbed wire fence. And the barbed wire runs along and it leans right up against the tree, and the tree will have enclosed that. It took it into account. You cut yourself and the white corpuscles come. You can interpret these mechanically, or you can interpret them in terms of actual will. And Schopenhauer, in another wonderful paper of his, The Will in Nature, speaks about evolution in almost Lamarckian terms as coming not simply from the Darwinian mechanistic way of explaining it, variation of species, random variation, natural selection and survival of the fittest. No, he says, the impulse is from inside. It is to differentiation, it is to expansion, it is to discovery, it is to development. Now, it's that whole idea of a will that is antecedent to our experience of things and which can be experienced through things, and that is the one will in all things. Now, Schopenhauer takes, at least in certain way of inflecting all of this, what seems to be a pessimistic, negative attitude toward this. This one will in nature moves everything to eat everything else. The life lives by consuming life. And then there comes a time in human consciousness when there are certain types of people who say, oh, that shouldn't be that way. So we start by being vegetarians. And if we're Jains, we start by not eating at all. And Schopenhauer says at one place, life is something that should not have been. it's a mistake that everything should be eating everything else. That's taking the position of the object in the world. Not of the dynamic, it's the same nature that's eating itself through several figures. And when Nietzsche comes along then, and reads Schopenhauer, one of his early papers was Schopenhauer as educator, absolutely given all the way to Schopenhauer. He takes the other attitude toward this eating it itself. And he says, yes, this is not only as it is, but as it should be. It can't be otherwise. Now, what this brings in is a terrific emphasis on what the tender-minded call violence. That's what nature is. Every now and then you see something that opens your mind to this. Last year, I think it was in May, May Geographic, or maybe it was 2 years ago, there was a picture that just lifted the hair on my head. It was of a gazelle being eaten by three cheetahs. Cheetahs are kind of leopard. And you had this animal lying on the ground with three cheetahs eating its belly, and the animal was alive, and its head was lifted in a kind of plea for compassion or mercy. Can you say yay to that? You've got to. So the artist now has to disengage himself from the ethical, phenomenal way of thinking and put himself in the position of this dynamic of the will, and at the same time not lose his time-space position, his ethical position. There is a conflict between ethics and metaphysics that runs right through the whole problem of art. And as soon as an artist begins to let the ethical dominate over the metaphysical insight, his work becomes cliché, it becomes cerebral, he's lost the energy, and it goes. You can have a propaganda art, you know, social realism and all that kind of garbage, but that has nothing to do with the breakthrough of art. And this is a problem that struck Mann and struck Joyce. And for Mann, it became quite crucial when Hitler came into Germany. He lost his aesthetic double vision, and his work declined. And that took place between volumes 3 and 4 of the Joseph novels in the 40s. Total transformation, Mann. So now to get closer to Mann, I'm trying to give the Kantian idea of the phenomenality in time and space. The will in nature, as Schopenhauer stresses it, and the one will, the one consciousness in all things. And then the ambiguity that comes out of that as a result. Two positions. Enthusiasm about the one that moves through all things, and special care and concern for the individual thing that is being destroyed by this. One of Nietzsche's very early works, and is one of the great works of the 19th century, is The Birth of Tragedy. And this is a work that tremendously influenced Mann, even deeper than Mann knew, as you'll see in a little while. What he points out there is that in the Greek tragedy, the two aspects are brought to a beautiful balance. The aspect of concern for the individual entity, what Nietzsche called the principium individuationis, the individuating principle, and the energy of the will, which brings forth and destroys all things. The energy of the will is represented in the god Dionysos, and the concern for the individual entity is what's represented in the, what might I say, radiance of the god Apollo. And Nietzsche shows in the world as well, in the Birth of Tragedy, how in Greek tragedy these two principles are perfectly united. There is concern for the individual, but there is the rapture that comes when, through the individual's dissolution, you have experienced the power of the will, which is your own dynamic and all. It's a beautiful thing. Now, in Thomas Mann's writing, the accent on rhythm and music, the musicality of his prose, which you just don't get in translation, but which in his German is firm and exquisite. With that, you have the Dionysian principle. And then his precision in attention to details. His writing is plastic. With that, you have accent on the Apollonian principle. And then in Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, he asks this question. Why is it that when Socrates' mind comes along, asking philosophical questions from the standpoint of rational consciousness, the art of the tragedy declines? Its great strength is in Aeschylus. Its last sort of cliché stage is in Euripides. And why is it that the philosophical mind always turns the dynamic of nature into a problem? Life in its last stages becomes problematic. We hear now the marriage problem. And we hear now women that don't know whether they're women or not, you know? That question, what's the difference between men and women after all? One friend of mine answered, I can't conceive. When I was a boy, I asked whether women should have be educated, and look what's happened. They've lost the natural knowledge of what they are, and they're programming themselves to a lot of masculine ideas and intentions. Here comes philosophy as the critic of nature. The world shouldn't be the way it is. This is the mental overtaking the dynamic of the will. So Nietzsche asked this question, why is it that when the philosopher comes in, like Socrates, art goes out? Socrates had a muse that came to him one day and said, Socrates, learn to sing, practice music. And so Nietzsche came up with the ideal. The rescue would be the music singing Socrates. This was Thomas Mann's ideal for his own art. You have the Dionysian principle in the wonderful poetry of his prose, the rhythms, the sounds, choices of words that would carry past just the verbal reference. You have the Apollonian in the attention to the temporal and spatial image and separate entity, great attention. And finally, that explication that comes along always, telling you the meaning, not criticizing it, but affirming it. The mind that doesn't take nature apart, but the mind that celebrates it. Now, I might just say that in general, that is the principal difference between Western and Eastern philosophy. In the West, in general, the mental slant turned criticism onto nature. You have a critical analytical, but the Oriental philosophers interpreted nature, interpreted myth, explicated it without criticizing it. And so, when Schopenhauer brings the Oriental into the Occidental, he brings that explication attitude rather than criticism, and Nietzsche then gives a new push to it with his total affirmation of everything in the world. Nietzsche's wonderful word, amor fati, love of fate. He says, if you criticize or wish to change one detail of your life, you've unraveled the whole thing. Your life is such a net. And I know that this is a very important pedagogical suggestion. Say yes to it, to your mistakes, to everything that goes to pieces. When a calamity comes, that is the period of dissolution out of which recreation will come. But the recreation has to find what was faulty in the position that then dissolved and what now carries me past that. And it's out of destruction comes creation. This is the Dionysian principle. Affirmation of the pain, of the anguish, of the fact that nature tears itself apart. Now, this gives a kind of, for our rather tender-minded attitude that has been cultivated particularly recently, this gives a kind of chill to us when we read what is actually implied in the art of these men. They're talking about the dynamic of things as they are, not as they should be. And then the quality of pity and compassion, mitleid, suffering with, comes in. In South America, in the Inca and pre-Inca mythologies of South America, there's an image of a deity who is shown with tears streaming down from his eyes. Those tears are the fertilizing rain that bring forth life. But when life is brought forth, then all the pain of life is brought forth too, so there are tears of compassion as well. That's the ambiguity of this whole thing. It's a wonderful image. The God weeping, whose very tears are creating the world of pain and suffering. And you're not going to get rid of pain and suffering because that's the very essence of time. And so we come to the Buddha idea, all life is sorrowful. It is. And what is the escape from sorrow? The nirvana, which is getting past the desire that it should be this way or the fear that it might be that way, to the immovable point. And that immovable point, as we'll be seeing a little later, is the point of art. Now, Imman's little Herr Friedman, the story is a very touching one. It's of a little cripple, a chap who, when he was a baby, was dropped by the nurse. The book, the little story starts, Die Amma hatte die Schuld. It was the nurse's fault. She dropped him, and he grew up a little, tiny little hunchback. And so as a child, he could not participate in the wonderful games of love and play, but he built a life for himself. A substitute life. He learned to enjoy the song of the birds in the park when he would go for a walk in the park. He learned to play the violin. He enjoyed the theater. And he said, you know, just life itself, that is validation enough. And then one day, a coach went by, you know, we're back in the 19th century, before automobiles, from a wealthy house, a coach went by, and in it was a perfectly stunning woman, and he was hit in that wonderful way, and he said, my God, you know. And so he was struck with the beauty of this woman. And then at a great social event, big lawn party one evening, he actually met the woman. And she said she had a feeling of sympathy and interest in him. And she said, let's go into the garden and talk. So she takes him to a little park, a bench, and right nearby is a stream. And she said, oh, Mr. Friedman, how long have you had your infirmity? This is the mirror held up to nature. And he told her, and she said, and you haven't been happy, have you? And he said, well, I've been doing this and that, and I'm enjoying life. And she said, that was really brave of you. He went to pieces. And then he falls on his knees to her, and she is overcome then by revulsion for this, and she pushes him down, gets up and walks away, and he goes to the stream, puts his head in the stream. He had seen its lights reflected in her eyes, and leaves his head there and drowns himself. This is written just about the time of Ibsen's Wild Duck. And the theme is, life requires lies. You have to make up little lies. This is what we call the search for meaning. Just something to make it possible for your secondary mentality to take it, to live this thing out. The world is will and idea. And also you get there the idea of relationship and the woman in particular as the revealer. On my 50th birthday, I received a postcard from a lady friend of mine, and it was a Picasso picture. And the name of the picture was The Death of a Monster. And what it showed was it was kind of Minotaur figure at the shore of a stream, and out of the stream comes a little water nixie, a kind of mermaid, and she just holds up a mirror to the monster, and an arrow goes right through him. Well, this is my 50th birthday. This is exactly little Herr Friedman. The woman comes up out of the world is will, the flowing water of the stream, and holds up the mirror, and one sees one's mere phenomenal character in the sense of a totality, and boy, you're blown. Isn't it wonderful the way these things come up here? Two artists, totally different fields, two different interpretations, but exactly the same mythological image. Well, in his talk on Freud, Thomas Mann pointed out that he had written this Kleine Herr Friedman just about 4 years before Freud's Interpretation of Dreams appeared, which is the book that made Freud what Freud has been historically. Of course, Freud had never read any of these people who had so informed himself, and Freud had not come to him. He had not gone to Freud. Freud had come to him. Now, possibly you remember Freud's analysis of the nature of the artist. It occurs in one of the papers in the introductory lectures on psychoanalysis. The artist is one who has great desire for women and fame, but he is unable to achieve them. And so he compensates by going back into the world of fancy and fantasy. He fantasizes. Now, of course, for Freud, fantasy is based on all kinds of infantile calamities, traumatic experiences, and all that kind of thing. So it's out of all his early traumatic experiences and all that the artist brings forth his fantasies. And these fantasies help other people who don't have the power to have a success in the world of money and women. That's about what Freud was really interested in. And so these people buy his books. And there, through his fantasy, he was able to achieve what he had wanted all the time. I mean, money, fame, and the love of women. It was a pretty reductive interpretation of the artist, and Jung and Mann knew this when he stood up to celebrate Freud, so he was giving him the load right back. Little Herr Friedman was that kind of relationship to the art. It was a compensation for him. And it was his life's lie. There is one kind of art that is of that order, but there's the other kind of art that holds the mirror up to nature, that comes out of the abyss and says, and kills, shoots past. Well then, Mann went on, and he said, my Buddenbrooks. How many here have read Buddenbrooks? This is a fantastic novel to have been brought forth by a young man in his early 20s. It is the story of a German family throughout the 19th century, four generations, beginning with the old great-grandfather, who's wearing an 18th century wig and knickers like George Washington, and Benjamin Franklin and all. And then his son, who's called the consul, who has the wind-blown hair of the romantics, you know, Keats and Shelley and Byron and all of that. And then in the middle of the century, and this is the main family of the book, these three children of the family, Christian, Thomas, and Tony. Tony is the daughter. With this great firm that the old man has instituted for them, and their whole life is bound to the firm. And they're killing every impulse, every natural, spontaneous impulse to life of their youth in order to dedicate themselves to the firm. And what you begin to have is such a disengagement from the real dynamic of life that they begin to make basic mistakes. Mistakes in choosing their spouses, not in terms of nature, but in terms of relationship to the prestige of the firm, and so forth and so on. And what Bond did in this wonderful Buddenbrooks was actually trace what was happening in Europe itself throughout the 19th century. A movement away from the romantic dynamic of life into practicality, concern for how things had best be, prudence over the dynamic of nature and so forth. And then out of this comes this little boy, Hanno, the son of Thomas, who sees how difficult life is for his father and so forth. And the little boy becomes interested in the arts, but he doesn't have the discipline to achieve the technique for the art. So he becomes the same kind of little dilettante and finally is sickly and dies. And what it is a story of the cycle, the morphology, you might say, of an organic form. That firm and the 19th century is the organic form of a European social inevitability, moving from youth and dynamism, then to concern, and then disintegration. Just as Mann was working on this, Oswald Spengler was working on the decline of the West. He brings forth a great book, which appeared within 2 years of The Magic Mountain and Ulysses, having to do with the dynamic of society in this way. Great cultures, they have their beginning, they have their culmination, they have their trying to hang on to it, they have their disintegration. This notion of what might be called psychological or spiritual morphology informed all of these works. Yeats has the same thing in his thinking and writing. This is what was happening in the early 19th century. The same time you have Schopenhauer opening up the whole story of the unconscious, and Freud then coming along, turning it into medical terms, you might say. Nietzsche, representing the dynamic and affirmation of this whole thing, comes in Zarathustra, terrific force. This is what's going to come out in the books and novels that we're going to be talking about.
As I previously mentioned, Campbell grounds this lecture in Thomas Mann's speech at Freud's 80th birthday celebration. Professor Campbell was clearly delighted by Mann's audacity at hijacking the occasion of Freud's birthday to speak about himself. Perhaps, to be more fair, to speak about the artist. But in this speech, Mann made some extraordinarily insightful remarks about myth. For instance, Thomas Mann called myth the foundation of life, the timeless schema from into which life flows when it reproduces its traits out of the unconscious. Now, this is an idea I think Professor Campbell would have no trouble endorsing. Furthermore, in his talk, Mann suggests that one must take a step backward into the past for a pattern, in other words, a mythic idea, into which one might, quote, slip as into a diving bell, and being thus at once disguised and protected, might rush upon his present problem. Thus his life was in a sense a reanimation, an archaizing attitude. But it is just this life as reanimation that is the life as myth. Unquote. In his celebration of Freud, Mann noted that Napoleon was said to have declared, "I am Charlemagne." Not, "I am like Charlemagne," or "my situation is like Charlemagne's," but simply, "I am he." Metaphor is the essence of myth. Metaphor isn't a reference to something else. That's a simile. "I am like Charlemagne" is a simile. Metaphor reconstructs ancient symbolic images and abstractions and renders them in contemporary flesh and blood. As Mann said, the myth is the legitimization of life. Only through and in it does life find self-awareness, sanction, consecration. Professor Campbell described how important the philosophies of Immanuel Kant, which Campbell charmingly calls a brilliant dryness, and Arthur Schopenhauer were to Mann. In focusing on Kant, particularly Kant's notion of transcendental idealism, Campbell could not have found another single concept of Kant's which has so little interpretive consensus. However, being well fortified by the bravado of ignorance, I want to make some comments on the usefulness of Kant in a mythological sense. Kant's fourth paralogism states that the soul is conscious and aware of the existence of only itself, and of all other things only as representations. And he defines transcendent idealism as the doctrine that all appearances are to be regarded as mere representations and not the things in themselves. Additionally, we can only discern appearance in space and time, not the things in themselves, because space and time are also forms of our conscious perceptual apparatuses. We are able to think about or imagine the thing in itself, and the thing in itself may even impact us, but we cannot come to know it in itself. These constraints of perception seem to, one might say, necessitate mythic thinking, the kind of thinking that sees through appearances, that is non-literal and non-linear, relying on irony and mythopoesis to create a sense of order and beauty. Arthur Schopenhauer was among the first philosophers to assert that at its core, the universe is not a rational place, that it is a ground of suffering, of violence and heartache, and endlessly craving blind impulse with no end in sight, ignorant, unfair, absolutely free, entirely self-determining, and almighty. Not surprising, then, that Schopenhauer's philosophy is often regarded as pessimistic. But it isn't only pessimistic. It attempts to accept the world exactly as it is, evoking a sense of radical acceptance and affirmation of the world which both Buddhism and Nietzsche teach us is a fundamental affirmation of self, of experience, and of all existence. Schopenhauer was among the first philosophers to incorporate significant elements of South Asian philosophy and spirituality, such as asceticism, the world's appearance, Atman, and other ideas contained in the Upanishads. In his book, The World is Will and Idea, he wrote, quote, "In the whole world, there is no study so beneficial and so elevating as that of the Upanishads. It has been the solace of my life. It will be the solace of my death, unquote. In this lecture, Professor Campbell referred to Schopenhauer's paper, which he probably read in the original German, The Foundations of Morality, in which Schopenhauer argues that morality and moral behavior arise from compassion, which he describes as, quote, the immediate participation in the suffering of another, and thus the prevention or the elimination of it. Only insofar as an action has sprung from compassion does it have moral value, and every action resulting from any other motives has none, unquote. Often people behave well because of laws mandating or prohibiting certain kinds of behaviors, or because they desire or fear religious rewards and punishments. And such actions are always rooted in the ego's desire for some subjective benefit. Schopenhauer regards compassion as egoless because one does not feel different from the one suffering, be it another person or an animal or even the planet itself. Likewise, Kant's categorical imperative states that a person's behavior should be in accord with an absolute, unconditional requirement that must be obeyed without exception, which has intrinsic value and is justified as an end in itself, which significantly diminishes the ego and seems to cry out for acts of compassion. In his book, Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, Kant put it this way: act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. Professor Campbell noted that Oriental philosophy and Kantian metaphysics were identical. And for quite some time, modern Chinese philosophy has acknowledged the striking similarity between Kant, particularly where he writes about duty, and the Neo-Confucianists. Kant discusses at great length both duties and rights, but he privileges duty in his system. He argued that rights are a byproduct of duty rather than vice versa. Even Nietzsche in Beyond Good and Evil called Kant the Chinaman of Königsberg, and in all likelihood that remark was made in light of this metaphysical similarity. Schopenhauer's will, Campbell argues, is better translated as waves or energy, and Vorstellung, idea, is better translated as image. Indeed, there are other translations of the word Vorstellung, such as imagination, idea, perception. And truly, Schopenhauer's Wille shares much in common with Asian ideas like the Tao or the Atman. Professor Campbell notes that the West sees consciousness as a product of the brain, and Eastern philosophies see the brain as a product of consciousness. The philosopher Thomas Nagel tackled this issue in his unsurprisingly controversial 2012 book, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False, insisting that a new and different understanding of nature is needed in order to plausibly explain consciousness. It's my opinion, reading between the lines of Nagel's very carefully and technically worded argument, that he is suggesting that mind or consciousness is perhaps a, or even the, fundamental constituent of the universe. Professor Campbell notes that Schopenhauer thought that even the impulse of evolution is from within, from the will. And one finds echoes of Schopenhauer in Professor Nagel's speculations. Concepts like Schopenhauer's Wille, Buddha consciousness, God, or Atman may be reconsidered as reflections of a universe in which consciousness precipitates matter rather than the other way around. Perhaps, rather than a big bang, there may have been a big awakening. Professor Campbell believes that there is a conflict between ethics and metaphysics that runs through all art, and the challenge the artist faces is to largely disengage from the phenomenological space-time ethical position and put themselves in the position of the dynamic of the will, which means to affirm life exactly as it is, in all its madness, all of its violence, and all of its irrationality. Campbell says that as soon as the artist lets the ethical position dominate the art, it becomes cliché, cerebral, and lacks the vitality of life. But how does one refrain from waging war on life's ruthlessness and manage to, as Nietzsche put it, affirm not only oneself, but all existence? The natural impulse is to devote oneself to one and dismiss the other categorically, thereby avoiding the dissonance of having to entertain two competing psychic realities. Once we've dispelled one of these possibilities, we set out to try to perfect the real, or conversely, intensify our longing for the ideal. In his book, The Mythic Dimension, Joseph Campbell notes that the function of art is not, quote, annihilation of one condition or the other, but celebration, unquote. We are better served by thinking yes and rather than either or, privileging the type of thinking reflected in what Campbell calls the true poetry of the poet, rather than the poetry overdone of the prophet and the poetry done to death of the priest. Now, the prophets and the priests tend towards literal, concrete interpretations of mythopoiesis. They tend to use substantive language when speaking or writing about God, and from that frequent customary usage, they assume that every substantive idea or expression has an actual substantial something behind it. Through this overdetermined presumption, they degrade a poetic notion to a prosaic pronouncement and come to understand God as an actual thing or being instead of a metaphor for some ineffable truth. Art allows us to glimpse the ideal while still rooted in the real. It gives us the double vision. I call it irony. Campbell called it the double optic of the artist. It gives us the double vision we need to make sense of this terrifying and fascinating mystery of existence and see in it an attitude of play, the divine play of spirit, the play of the elan vital, and the dynamism of life itself. Now, there is a moment about 46 minutes into his lecture that I must admit made me cringe. Professor Campbell asserts that the philosophical mind always turns the dynamic of nature into a problem and insists that the world shouldn't be the way it is. As an example of this, he offers what he called the problem of marriage, which apparently he regards as the problem of, quote, women not knowing if they're women or not, unquote. He went on to opine about the danger of women educating themselves and losing the, quote, natural knowledge of what they are, becoming instead more masculine. He even told a bad joke about the difference between men and women, which in a room full of pioneering, brilliant, innovative female Jungian analysts, it was a joke that landed utterly flat. Barely a twitter passed through the largely silent room. It was a little jarring to hear such an anachronistic thought expressed in 1982, especially from a man I find to be an advocate of intellectual thought and development universally. That intellection can be gendered is an archaic notion, and surprising to think that Campbell would think so, especially in light of teaching young women at Sarah Lawrence for 38 years, not to mention marrying a smart, immensely talented, and fiercely independent woman whom he quite clearly adored. There are, however, moments in all of our lives when we find ourselves possessed by our own shadow, the dark side of our psyche, and we say things that seem inconsistent with who we are or who we're trying to be. Politically, Campbell was conservative. Perhaps it would be more accurate to say he was a libertarian, a firm believer in a courageous individualism like that displayed by the knights errant in the Arthurian romances. He was suspicious of the Republicans' alliance with Christian fundamentalism in the 1980s. He was pro-choice, and being a lover of nature, he was disappointed in their inadequate stand on protecting the environment. In his later years, perhaps due to the influence of women like Joan Halifax and Maureen Murdoch, he became much more open to the feminine values present in myth. In the book Pathways to Bliss, for instance, one may read a transcript of audience questions, and after some important discussion regarding the issue of the feminine in myth, Professor Campbell emphasized that, and I'm quoting from the book now, "The important thing, however, is not for the masculine to be dominant or the feminine to be dominant. What is to be dominant is the conjunctio oppositorum, the conjunction of the two." I think the argument may be made that in the 1980s, he was beginning to move away from traditional notions of male and female efficacy. I don't really know what else to say to this. The simple human, all too human truth is that each one of us is, well, complicated. Such complications can be embraced, however, and in such an embrace, new accords may be realized. In Dr. Faustus, the book Campbell so disliked, what Mann wrote applies to Campbell too. Quote, "But admiration and sadness, admiration and worry, is not that almost a definition of love? There are people with whom it is not easy to live, but whom it is impossible to leave." Unquote. Oh, and by the way, I don't think philosophy is a critic of nature, or that it says the world shouldn't be as it is. I think that rather philosophy is critical of the way we think about and understand nature, how we understand ourselves and the world. Philosophy insists that we think differently about life and the world. Finally, I found it fascinating that Professor Campbell disliked Mann's novel, Dr. Faustus, calling the book a betrayal of Mann's own life, while softly musing, quote, "Something happened. Something had happened," unquote. Now, Dr. Faustus happens to be one of my favorite Mann novels, and I find it just as layered and intricate, just as laden with meaning and myth as Mann's other great works. So I think the something that happened to Thomas Mann was simply life, his life. Two horrific world wars fought in his own country during his lifetime. Forced to live in exile for most of his life, the suicide of two of his children, condemned and reviled by Germans for fleeing Germany, and though he was by then a U.S. citizen, harassed and hounded out of his adopted country by Joseph McCarthy's paranoid allegations. So yes, the problems of nationalism, war, and cultural decline loom large in Dr. Faustus. And that may be what Professor Campbell disliked about the book. It appeared in the treatment of these ideas to move away from the ironic double optics of art and ventured into the ethics of time and space. Mann clearly said in many venues and interviews that art and politics are not separate worlds. And finally, I think that when a character in Faustus remarked that, quote, "Aestheticism is the herald of barbarism," it may have been a bridge too far for Campbell and felt like an artistic betrayal of one of his most cherished ideals, the ideal of aesthetics. There's so much more to say, but this will have to do for now. I'm afraid I'm already taxing your patience. Thank you very much for joining me and listening to what was, for me, one of the more compelling and interesting Joseph Campbell lectures I have yet heard. I'm so glad you're joining us for our second season of podcasts, and I hope you'll return next month for another Joseph Campbell lecture on Pathways with Joseph Campbell.
Pathways with Joseph Campbell is a production of the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Mythmaker Podcast Network, and is produced by John Booker and Elias Mirnoff. Executive producer, Robert Walter. Your host has been Bradley Olson. Editing and audio services provided by Seth Balin. Music exclusively provided by APM Music. For more podcasts and information about Joseph Campbell, please visit jcf.org.